Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are tackling a text that is, well, both globally influential and, let's be honest, frequently misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at Michael Cook's really fantastic work, The Quran. A very short introduction.
It's an amazing starting point.
It really is. If you're looking for a rigorous, objective and just clear-headed way to understand the text at the heart of Islam, this is where we're going
to
start.
That's absolutely right. And our mission today, really, is to use Cook's framework to unpack some of the biggest questions.
Nice.
Well, how did the text even come to exist? What does its internal structure tell us? And, you know, maybe most importantly, why does it remain such a profoundly relevant force today?
Right. It shapes lives, law, art, politics for over 1.8 billion people.
Exactly.
The relevance hook here is just massive. We're talking about the core doctrine of a global civilization.
You really can't overstate it.
You just can't be an informed global citizen today without understanding this foundational text. I mean, it drives legal systems, cultural expression, political movements. It's
yeah.
It's non-negotiable knowledge.
Precisely. We need to move beyond the headlines and gain some genuine fluency here. Historically and theologically.
Okay, so let's start with our guide. Who is Michael Cook, and why should we trust his take on a text that is so often defined by internal religious tradition?
Cook is, well, he's a titan in the academic world, a distinguished professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton.
Right.
He's known for his incredible linguistic expertise, Arabic, other Semitic languages. But the key thing, and this is crucial, is that he approaches the Quran not as a theologian.
But as a historian.
As a rigorous historian.
Yes.
And that historical perspective, grounding everything in that 7th century context, that's what makes this book so different, so unique for the general reader.
It is. Cook is all about intellectual honesty. He sets up this framework that, you know, tries to navigate between what he calls
I love this analogy.
The Scylla of uncritical devotion, which treats the text as immune to any kind of historical question.
Exactly. And on the other side, the Charybdis of reductive secularism.
Which just dismisses it as, what, an ancient political document?
Right, just an artifact. So he's charting a course right between those two dangers.
You have to steer really carefully there, respecting the text's profound religious meaning while also applying that academic rigor.
Exactly. He's known for demanding evidence.
Hmm.
That's why his earlier, very influential and often debated work, Hagiarism, made such waves. When you read Cook, you know you're getting a deep, evidence-based dive.
Okay, so with that scholarly foundation set, what's the central thesis? If you had to boil the whole book down, what does Cook say is necessary for us to really understand the Quran?
His core argument is that the Quran demands a multi-perspectival approach.
Yeah.
You just can't understand it in isolation.
What do you mean by that?
You have to view it through a historical lens, a literary one, a theological one, and a cultural one.
Yeah.
And they're all interdependent. You can't just pick one.
So a full 360-degree view. Where does he start the journey then? Does he jump right into the big theological ideas?
No, and I think this is very wise. He starts with the historical setting.
On the ground.
On the ground.
Yeah.
The radical context of 7th century Arabia. We look at the polytheism, the rigid tribal structures, the whole world of Mecca. And that groundwork is so vital because it shows you just how explosive the Quranic message really was.
Revolutionary doesn't even feel like a strong enough word.
No, it doesn't.
Because the core doctrine that comes out of Cook's analysis is this uncompromising message of Tawhid.
Absolute, indivisible monotheism. And that is the engine of the entire movement. Tawhid was a direct challenge to everything.
Socially, economically.
Spiritually. It's dismantled the existing system of blood ties and, you know, the prophet from the Kaaba's idols.
Yeah.
And replaced it with a universal community.
The Ummah.
The Ummah, united only by submission to one God.
That shift is so important. Let's really zoom in on that. Let's get into the specifics of that revolutionary setting. What did Mecca actually look like religiously before the prophet's mission?
Cook describes a system that was, you know, functional. They certainly acknowledged a high god, Allah.
Okay.
But he was worshipped alongside a whole host of other minor deities.
Mm-hmm.
The Kaaba itself, which was the center of Meccan commerce, was basically a polytheistic hub. It had idols to goddesses like Alat, Al-Uzza, Manat.
And your status, your security, it all depended on your kinship, your tribe.
Entirely on tribal honor, yes.
So this message of Tawhid wasn't just some abstract spiritual idea. It was a political blueprint for a total social upheaval.
That's a great way to put it.
It was replacing a hierarchy of blood and wealth with one based on piety, which is why the elite fought it so hard.
Of course. It was a direct attack on their power and their income. The message demanded that your loyalty shift from your tribe to this new universal community of believers.
Okay, so that sets the stage. Now, what about the text's physical journey? This is where it can get confusing for people. How do you get from oral revelations to a single book?
Well, the traditional account, which Cook treats very carefully, explains that the revelations came down over about 23 years.
Right.
And initially, verses were memorized. Followers would transcribe them on whatever was available. Bits of leather, palm leaves, even animal shoulder blades. It was all very decentralized.
Which I imagine created a huge problem after the prophet's death.
A crisis, really. Cook points out that many of the early memorizers, the reciters, were killed in the battles that followed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And this raised the terrifying possibility that parts of the revelation could be permanently lost or corrupted.
So that necessity is what drove the standardization process.
It did. A collection was first commissioned under the first caliph, Abu Bakr. But the definitive version, the one we have today, came later under the third caliph, Uthman.
And that's the origin of the Uthmanic Codex.
That's it. The text we read today.
So for you, the listener, what does Cook tell us this process guarantees about the Quran's integrity?
Well, Cook argues it ensured an authoritative text.
Mm-hmm.
Uthman ordered this standardized version to be created, and then copies were sent out to the major centers of the expanding empire.
I see.
So this provided a universally agreed upon text. The fundamental words have been fixed since the 7th century, even if later scholarship debated things like vocalization or interpretation.
Okay, so that's the how of the collection. Now let's talk about the what of the structure, because this is where a lot of new readers, myself included, kind of hit a wall.
Yeah.
You pick up a translation and it seems so nonlinear. Why does it feel so disjointed compared to other scriptures?
It's because it's a fundamentally different kind of book. Cook really emphasizes this. It is not arranged chronologically. It's not thematic.
It's arranged how?
Roughly by descending chapter or surah length.
Yeah.
The longest chapters, which are often the latest revelations, the ones dealing with law for the new community, are at the front.
So the first thing you read is often about law and social organization, while those fiery, poetic early sermons are sort of hidden near the back in the shorter chapters.
Exactly. And that distinction between the early Meccan surahs, shorter, intensely poetic, focused on theology and judgment, and the later Medinan surahs, longer, more prosaic, focused on law and community governance, that is the key.
It's the key to understanding its development.
It is. The text literally shifts from being sermons about the day of judgment to being instructions for running a state.
And the literary power is so important here. Cook talks about Saj, the rhymed prose. If the structure is nonlinear, the rhythm is what gives it its power.
Absolutely. The text is designed to be heard, to be recited aloud, not just read silently. The power of Saj is integral to its claim of inimitability, or ajayas.
Meaning
the idea that the text is so aesthetically perfect, so linguistically powerful, that no human could have possibly authored it.
So it must be divine speech.
Exactly. This auditory performative dimension is just fundamental to Islamic culture.
Let's pivot to the theology then. How does the Quran position itself next to, say, Judaism and Christianity?
It sees itself as part of a long, continuous line of prophecy. Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus.
Right.
They all delivered the exact same core message. Absolute monotheism. So from the Quranic perspective, it's not starting a new religion. It's restoring the original pure message.
And this is where that idea of a corrective dialogue comes in, right? It's not just referencing them. It's actively critiquing how those faiths developed.
Precisely. The Quran venerates Jesus. It affirms his virgin birth, his status as a prophet, his miracles, but it explicitly and vehemently denies the Christian doctrine of the Trinity and his divinity.
He's a messenger.
A powerful messenger of God, but only a messenger. Cook points out this is a theological restoration, a correction of what it views as a deviation from God's original pure command.
Okay, so it sees itself as the final definitive word. What about the ultimate fate of humanity? What's the eschatological vision here?
It's all centered on profound accountability and urgency. Life is a finite test. The day of judgment is imminent. And Cook notes the very visceral sensory descriptions of the afterlife.
You can almost feel it.
Yes. Your deeds will be weighed. Paradise, Jannah, is a lush garden of eternal bliss. And hell, Jahannam, is a place of vivid fire and torment. This imagery creates a deep sense of moral responsibility.
That intensity leads us right into the big ideas. What are the core themes Cook leaves us with that connect this ancient texts to today?
I think there are three that really stand out. The first is historical contextualization.
Right.
Cook makes it impossible to just pull a verse out of context,
yeah,
to situate it. Was it revealed in Mecca as an early warning or in Medina as a later law?
That rigor prevents the simplistic and often dangerous readings.
It does. And the second one is absolutely vital for understanding the modern Muslim world.
The idea that there's no single interpretation.
Yes, interpretive diversity. Cook highlights the huge, rich tradition of commentary or tafsir over centuries. It's full of scholarly debate.
Which is why you can't talk about the Muslim view on anything.
Exactly. It challenges fundamentalist claims to exclusive truth. It helps you understand why different groups can cite the same text to support vastly different views on politics or gender. The text is living.
And the third theme?
That aesthetic component we touched on. The Quran as divine speech. Because it's seen as the literal, uncreated word of God, it elevates everything connected to it.
Like recitation.
Recitation. The spiritual power of its sound and why calligraphy became the highest art form in Islamic civilization. It's an aesthetic experience as much as a legal guide.
Those three lenses, context, diversity, and aesthetics, give you such a clearer picture. Cook also has this way of summarizing things that just sticks with you. What are some of his most notable insights?
Let's go back to the one that defines his whole method. Understanding the Quran requires us to navigate between the Scylla of uncritical devotion and the Charybdis of reductive secularism.
Right. It's a call for intellectual courage to hold both historical scrutiny and religious respect at the same time.
It is. And then there's his idea about its function.
Which is?
The Quran is not just a book to be read, but a revelation to be experienced. That really gets at the auditory performative dimension, how it shapes daily life, prayer. It's a sonic document.
I like that, a sonic document. And what about the last one, the measure of its impact?
Simply, the text that emerged from 7th century Arabia has become the foundation for a global civilization.
That just summarizes the monumental scale of it all. A text from a few people in a desert trading post came to underpin empires.
It's staggering when you think about it.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? How do we take this scholarly view and actually apply it in our lives?
Well, the first and most critical application is just becoming an informed global citizen.
Mm-hmm.
This knowledge gives you a foundation to understand world events beyond the headlines. So, for example, when you hear political talk about Sharia law, you now know its roots are in the Medinan surahs, and crucially, in that vast, debated, interpretive tradition of tafsir.
It's not a single unchanging code.
It's not. Secondly, this analysis is so useful for interfaith bridge building. Cook gives you a map.
How so?
By clarifying the points of deep theological continuity, the shared prophets, the monotheism, and the specific points of divergence, like the nature of Jesus, you can engage with respect, but also with precision.
And finally, the whole book is just a fantastic critical thinking model.
Absolutely. The method he uses, always asking about historical context, compilation, interpretation, it's a valuable tool for analyzing any foundational document, sacred text, constitution, whatever.
It teaches you to ask where text came from, not just what it says.
Exactly.
You know, what surprised me most in this deep dive was the sheer revolutionary nature of Tawhid as an economic force.
Interesting.
It wasn't just a spiritual idea. It was a deliberate act of socioeconomic disruption aimed squarely at the Meccan elite who profited from idolatry. That context explains all the initial persecution.
For me, the lasting insight is that scholarly rigor and genuine appreciation for a text can and should go hand in hand.
Compliment?
They are. Cook shows that the Quran is still this powerful, living document whose ability to speak to fundamental human concerns, social justice, personal accountability, ensures it's going to remain central in global affairs.
Right.
We just have to engage with it seriously. Intellectually.
A fantastic place to leave it. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhatra Foundation.